How do we judge greatness in others? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Brant Berglund, your host and study guide author. We're continuing our 13-week series studying the Synoptic Gospel of Matthew, the first book in the New Testament. And my conversation partners through this entire quarter are pastors Troy Fitzgerald and Jennifer Ogden, who serve as pastors of the Walla Walla University Church. And when we think about greatness, what are some of the key principles by which we judge greatness in other people today? If you were to maybe survey society, how would they judge greatness? Or what are some of the aspects they would put forward to say, this was what makes a person great? From your working with people, what have you seen?
I think there's some unhealthy views of greatness. I think there's some immediate superficial concepts about greatness. I think the quality about greatness that's so profound and it's so real in the people that I would see as great, either historically or the people in my life, is that they're not aware of it. They're the ones least aware of their own greatness. They're greatly about something else that matters to them more than them. And so they're not the ones that are, you know, looking at them. They're not the ones, you know, saying that they're great. It's others who say they're great, and they're too busy to acknowledge it half the time.
Greatness is not something that your average person is going to note about themselves. You have the Muhammad Ali's out there in the world who say, I'm the greatest. But that's not the norm.
No.
Yeah.
Jen, what have you seen in kind of the world? How does the world judge greatness that you've seen?
Well, I think we evaluate greatness by the amount of enthusiasm people are able to generate, by, you know, the people who follow them. I think we evaluate greatness by success in a business world, by bank accounts, you know, the Forbes 500, top richest people in the world, those sorts of things. I think we evaluate greatness by riches and influence and those sorts of things.
Athletic prowess, accomplishments.
Ability, yeah.
Media spotlight, somebody who's in the spotlight longer.
If you're a great athlete, you can be a great, there are a lot of great athletes that everybody sees, but then there are some people who become just great because they were of what they did. And again, I think it's a little skewed and sometimes a little short-sighted, but there are some enduring features of greatness that I think are good and biblical.
And we're going to find some of those today. Jesus, we're in the Book of Matthew chapter 18 today, and some of Jesus' disciples came to him and said, you know, who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom? And it makes me wonder if they want to know if their name will show up on that list, if they've made the kingdom's dean's list, so to speak, or if they really just want to know more about the kingdom. What does greatness look like? I think it's the former, not the latter, unfortunately. But how does Jesus respond here in Matthew 18? Who's the greatest? Does he pick one of his disciples and say, Peter? Last week we were talking about Peter maybe being that rock that Jesus builds his kingdom on, or at least his declaration. Peter, surely he's one of the greatest, right?
I want to let Jen answer this. She's halfway out of her chair right now because this is her world.
This is my world. This is a brilliant world. Jesus is hilarious. He could be a sit-down comedian because he pulls the small child up onto his lap and says, this is what you need to be like. In a world where children were not seen, in a world where children were not valued unless they grew to adulthood, he takes the smallest, most dependent person, I mean, another mouth to feed, another body to clothe, and at this point they are not benefiting anyone.
Until they become a worker in the world.
You're no good right now. You're just a burden to us. He takes that little child and says, be like this. The greatest in the kingdom of heaven is just like this, this little one.
You both work with young people. You both work with kids ranging in age from infants on up into high school and college. What is it about a child that Jesus could be pointing out to us? What kind of lesson is he trying to teach his disciples who were hoping they were the greatest? And now Jesus is saying, no, it's you say helpless, dependent. He takes a little child. What are the characteristics of children that Jesus really wants us to know? This is greatness. What are those features?
One of them for me is children tend to be very teachable. They're more curious than they are arrogant. But look for arrogant children. You can't find them. Curious children, questions. They'll challenge you, but that teachable spirit, that awareness that what there is to do in this day is something to learn. There's something to know. There's something to discover. There's something to go. There's an adventure, my little one says, to have. So there's that inquiry that mm-hmm. is open. Wow.
They're like sponges.
Yep.
I think that's what the kingdom's looking for.
And I wonder if Jesus knew in his disciples they were already getting to a place of fossilizing of the brain cells, and they weren't able to continue learning. But this goes along with some of Jesus' other words that the kingdom of heaven needs to be more like a fresh garment with a fresh patch put on it, not an old garment that could tear easily, right? Mm-hmm. The willingness mm-hmm. to absorb the teachings of Jesus. Mm-hmm. Jen, some of the things you've seen in children that you would say Jesus probably is prizing, setting as an example here.
Something I think that he probably appreciates is their hilarious honesty. Children are dreadfully honest. You know, the cousin of mine who walks into the restaurant and pats the belly of the big man sitting next to them, baby, you know, asking, are you pregnant? I think, you know, they're hilariously honest and they experience the world through everything they've already experienced. And they're just willing to explore and be out there and adventure and engage and learn, as Troy has said. But I think also they are extremely, extremely willing. They want to try it. Can I do that? Can I push the button? Can I touch the frog? Can I open the window? Can I drive the car? You know what I mean?
Almost to the point of annoying, but they want to have those experiences. How did the children respond to Jesus when they were around him? What do we see with kids and Jesus? What kind of relationship did kids have with Jesus? Were they aloof? Were they, did they use him as a jungle gym? What do we see?
Well, the scriptures aren't really that descriptive, but it does say that he had a way. They wanted to be around him. You know, they were trying to get to him, and the disciples prevented them from doing that. So if there's a prevention, there's the opposite of that. There are people trying to get there, and so I think he's endearing. I think he just called young people to him in an unmitigated, unmistakable way.
Mm-hmm. In today's world, we're careful with the people our children associate with. We know that there are people in the world who are not always safe with children. But Jesus somehow had a personality that the children were drawn to him. And from my personal experience, I've seen children have, in many ways, an uncanny ability to read character. There are certain people they just want to be around who are generally safe people, because the children have learned to trust them. And Jesus kind of gives me that picture here.
Oh, yeah. Well, the mothers would bring their kids to him as well.
Yeah. So they trusted him. The parents trusted him.
But even if you find kids that are a little bit shy, they still try. I mean, if there's somebody who's hard to get to know, they'll give that person a chance. So even for some of the harder to get to know people, they'll work on them for a while.
Yeah, they will.
Is it possible if the young people are also more humble because of their openness and the disciples tend to be somewhat arrogant, is it possible to fake this childlike humility? Is it possible to pretend? Can I try and be like a kid in all these right ways?
Yeah, I think we can try and pretend, but I think we're going to fail. You know, and then we develop these amazing layers of hiding our guilt, our shame, our vulnerability. And we become a very stinky onion if we're not careful.
Appropriate for the valley. For
we're going to get all the agricultural. I've got some grapes coming up.
Yeah. So, I just think that if we are really open and honest, that the humility will come naturally. You know, it's not a place of shame that children operate from. It's not a place of guilt. It's a place of honesty. And I think we can do that. But I don't think we can fake it. I think you can fake it for a time, but it's going to be transparent.
Long term now.
You can fake, you can do things for other motives that are good things. You can do humble-like things because of those motives. But again, going back to kind of a definition that I'm working on, is that you're not aware of yourself. Mm. Somebody who's humble is not first thinking about themselves, they're thinking of something else first as an impulse. So it's really a nature thing. It's who they are, not what they do. So if humility is something you think you can do, I can act humbly, well then put the emphasis on the word act, because That's probably what it is.
In that sense, then, it begs another question for me. Can I know if I've become childlike? Can I get to a point in my life where I can look back and say, I think I'm becoming more like a child than I was, even as I get older? Or is this something that I'll never have a handle on and I'll always be wondering, did I ever do what Jesus wanted?
That's kind of like saying, you know, humility is my second best quality, just right behind greatness. You know, it's not. I don't think so. I don't.
Jesus asked me to become like a little child, and I want to know how to do it.
Yeah, will and I think it's important to be able to look back and see the steps, right? That's the beauty of the Christian journey, is that we're changing as we go. And I think we can say, oh, today I'm not the same that I was yesterday. And today, by God's grace, I'm not the same that I was 5 years ago. Yeah. So I think we can look back in that aspect. But can I think we can ever say, I've made it, I'm a little kid? No, I don't think we're going to be able to say that.
I think as springtime comes alive here, we see all these flowers that open up during the course of the day to the sun. And I don't think they're looking at themselves. I don't think the tulips will look at the petals of the tulips and say, wow, this is a brilliant red that I am. You know, it's doing what it does naturally. This is who they are, not what they do. So it's, you know, not doing this to be something, but because you are something, you do this.
Part of the challenge of Jesus' kingdom is that sometimes people do err and make mistakes. Mm. And the need comes for forgiveness. And Jesus talks about a sheep going astray and going back and bringing that sheep back to the fold. And then Jesus speaks about his church, his congregation, his people, and the need to forgive.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. How childlike is it to forgive? Do you see children holding a grudge for a long time against their friends?
No.
Trade a Lego, a doll, whatever it is, and you're on the road again. They are the most resilient people when it comes to forgiveness and responding. I mean, I don't know. What do you think, Jen?
No, I totally agree with you. I think it takes a I'm sorry, oops, you know, and on they go. They're willing to forgive and they're willing to ask for it. Both. It's
and
a two-way street.
And living in that little community of their friends is so important to them. And it makes me wonder what the church would be like if we took each other's grievances far less seriously and the relationships far more valuably. And yet there are things about forgiveness that can also be difficult, things that can hinder it. I wish we had more time to talk about these things. We don't. Next week, we'll be moving on to discuss Jesus' entry into Jerusalem as we get into the last few days and hours of Jesus' life. We'll spend a significant time on those portions of Scripture, just as Matthew does. He spends several chapters there, and so will we. Pastors Jen and Troy, thank you again for being with me. Also, my thanks to Jared Miller and David Olson, our program engineers for this quarter, and also to all of you for listening in. Thank you for the good word. I'm Brant Berglund.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.